These are words spoken to some of the first Christians, some of the first followers of Jesus after his death and resurrection and ascension into heaven, the early church. James is writing to these people. And it doesn't make very comfortable reading, really. You've got a kind of a twin thing going on here. The way he addresses them. At times he addresses them brothers, friends. And at other times, you adulterous people. Those are strong words. But the whole letter is really asking that the early Christians, as much as it is asking us today as we follow Jesus, asking them to let God transform them. Don't just go for information and knowledge, but seek transformation in the power of God. And James wants us to be ever more like Jesus. Sometimes that will happen in huge, great leaps, as God does amazing things that turn us around. Often, that will be gentle, small, day by day, hour by hour steps. And James is addressing both in this whole letter. And today, he's really, here in chapter 4, looking at submitting to the lordship of Jesus Christ, who has given himself for us and who's left a gift of his Holy Spirit, and he's prepared a place for us in his Father's house, and we need to submit to him. Don't know if you remember, those of you that were around a few weeks ago, I had this spade wrapped up in a big box. I was given this nice shiny spade for Christmas by my in-laws. And when I brought it first time, it had never been used. And it was absolutely pristine. Would you just like to inspect? Look, there is some mud on it now. I've been doing some digging. I've started to use it, but the illustration of this spade was, it's all very nice, but if it remains shiny and clean and unused, then it's actually not worth having. And if we claim to be followers of Jesus, but we don't become more and more like him, if we don't put ourselves on the line for him, if we don't seek to walk in his ways, then, well, that's not faith being worked out. That's just religion. And Jesus spoke so strongly against empty religion. And James is speaking strongly here too, wanting us to submit. Let me tell you a little story about a guy who was on his roof, two stories high, up by the chimney, and he was putting an aerial on, and it's going fine, and then a gust of wind just caught him and he started to slip, and he sort of slithered down the tiles and was desperately trying to gain purchase to stop himself from falling, and eventually he grabs hold of the gutter. Thankfully it was an older house, iron gutters held him sturdy, and he was saying, "Help, help." I don't want to yell too loud because Hugo will cry. "Help!" he was yelling. And then he thought, "There's nobody here. I need to ask God for help. If there's anyone up there who can help me, please help me." And a voice comes from heaven saying, "I can help you." And he says, "Great! What have I got to do?" And the voice says, "Let go, and I'll catch you." And the guy says, "Is there anybody else up there that can help me?" Because sometimes What we have to do by submitting is not comfortable. It takes a little bit of a risk to trust that God is with us as we submit to him. Let's have a little look at this passage this morning. Really, there's two things going on. There's a bunch of stuff that James is saying, actually, this is not good. And he's speaking against behaviour after behaviour through chapter 4. And he's saying, this is not right. And alongside that, there are some remedies. There are some instructions as to how we can put that right. And so that's what I want us to do this morning. Just take a quick look through what James is saying. That is not on. And then look at what hope he gives us in the passage as well. So let's have a whistle-stop tour through this. Verse 1, straight in there. Just remember, by the way, end of verse chapter 3 last week, James is talking about peacemakers. James was talking about all that is wise is borne out in people that are peacemakers. Straight into chapter 4, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Couldn't be more opposite. Completely opposite to the good life that he speaks of in chapter 3, verse 13. Let that be seen in your good life. But instead, he's saying in verse 1, it's your desires that are winning, the ones that battle within you, the ones that in chapter 1 he said, well, your desires give birth to sin, and sin gives birth to death. Don't let those desires to do wrong, to quarrel, to put yourself first, don't let them win. He develops this in verse 2, where he's saying, actually, some of you quarrel and fight. You want something, you can't get it. I don't know whether they were what they were fighting over exactly. But it gets worse, doesn't it? You kill and you covet. Good grief. I'm sure I'd like to belong to a church where there are people killing each other. But then there are some that think that actually, in that first church, there were groups of people who'd come to faith who were belonged to kind of a grouping called the Zealots. And the Zealots were pretty rough people. They were people who would have been prepared to kill in order to get what they thought was right. And there was kind of a religious background to them, wanting to see the Jewish people win through. But they were prepared to do that by means that certainly went against the Ten Commandments. And you could almost imagine if you were talking to a bunch of gang members who'd just recently come to faith and who'd learned to act and behave in a certain way, that maybe in a situation like that, that maybe there'd be some that would say, well, I'll sort him out for you. Giving you a hard time, Pastor. Let me sort him out for you. But maybe it's just that their words were killing one another. Maybe there was character assassination going on. We don't know, but it clearly wasn't good. Jumping into verse 3, James speaks about wrong motives. When you ask, you don't receive because you ask with wrong motives. You want stuff for the wrong reason. And then verse 4 kind of gets to the heart of it. You adulterous people. It's an image that's used against the faithlessness of the people of Israel. It's an image that says if you turn against God, then you commit adultery against God. And he's using that imagery here. He uses quite a lot of Old Testament imagery in this letter. And then he starts talking about friendship with the world. And that idea of friendship was about undivided loyalty. See, friendship was something much more than passing acquaintance in these terms. It was about total devotion to and influenced by. So it's not that we cut ourselves off into a holy huddle and isolate ourselves from the world. But nor do we become so comfortable with the world's way of operating that we make absolutely no difference. And here it's clear. And actually, if you look through the letter, think about it. Discrimination, favoritism, ignoring the needy, using all kinds of wrong words, selfish ambition, pursuing destructive pleasures. These are all addressed in James. All evidences that actually maybe there was still a kind of a friendship with the world amongst these Christians. It's quite possible that they weren't consciously choosing. Quite possible that they were just, that was just how it was, how they got used to living. And that they weren't allowing God to be at the centre. But if you jump down to verse 17, James makes it pretty clear. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. So as we know what it is that we should do and we opt not to do it, we opt to take the world's perspective, let's be very careful. Because James identifies that with sin. Now I want to just pause on verse 5 for a second, because some of the rest of this is kind of pretty rapid fire, picking out on stuff that is quite obviously sinful. But verse 5 is tricky. When I first read it, I kind of reread it and I thought, huh? And then I reread it and read it again and I still thought, huh? Now I don't know, in your pew Bibles, let me just grab a pew Bible, whether there's a little footnote to verse 5. Maybe somebody will find it before I find it. There is, yeah? Fab, okay. What does the footnote say, Judy?
It says, or that God jealously longs for the spirit that he made to live in us, or that the spirit he calls to live in us longs jealously.
Brilliant. Could I just grab that just for a second? Thank you. One of those little bits of the Bible where the Greek, and Malcolm's not here today who could help us out with this, but where the Greek is not ever so clear. And there are two or three ways that actually the words could be worked out into English. And it just perplexed me. So I thought, if it perplexes me, it may well perplex you. Might not, you might have never noticed it, and now I'm creating issues with you. But here we go. Verse 5. You could at first think that that says God is making us envy intensely. That the spirit God gives us makes us envy intensely. But if that is the right translation in the NIV, then that is not the right interpretation. Because what I believe from what James has already said in his letter, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 13, God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. Other bits where we know of the goodness and the perfection of God, that's not what's being said here in verse 5. But actually what's being said is that God gives us the spirit that lives in us. And that spirit has been broken by our sinfulness, and it envies intently. So James is acknowledging that the very core of our being is broken by sin. That which God gave us is marred and damaged. And it envies after what the world would have us envy after. So that's one way of looking at it. And the NIV translators have gone with that, but they have obviously in the footnotes put other possibilities. And I just wonder whether the one that says that God jealously longs for the spirit that he made to live in us, makes more sense in this context. Because you see, God is a jealous God, as we learn in Exodus chapter 20 at the beginning of the Ten Commandments. God wants his creation to be looking to him. And either side of that, in verse 4 and verse 6, I get that sense that that's what is going on here, that it is God who jealously yearns for us to follow him. He wants our hearts. And it's our sin that holds it away from him. And that kind of makes sense of where it says that the scripture says this, because there are plenty of references in the Old Testament to God's jealously yearning after his people. And that jealousy is not a sinful jealousy, but a deep yearning desire for the hearts of the people he created. But whatever way we read that, and we can kick that around, please talk to me afterwards and we can work that through further if you want to. But whatever way round it is, there is definitely a need for God. James continues, verse 8, to highlight the fact that each and every Christian is not perfect. He uses more Old Testament imagery in verse 8, where it says, "Wash your hands, you sinners, purify your hearts." The hands in Old Testament imagery kind of represented our deeds, stuff that we did. So he's saying, cleanse yourself of your deeds. And then our hearts was representative of that was our attitude, our inclination towards God. So he's saying, cleanse your hands, your deeds. Purify your hearts, your attitudes. Let's get everything right before God. Then he goes on to verse 9. Seems a bit bizarre, doesn't it? Grieve, mourn, and wail. Change your laughter to mourning and your joy to gloom. That's cheerful, isn't it? But again, James is kind of taking on something of an Old Testament prophet's way of speaking. If you think about some of the Old Testament prophets who were called by God to tell the people, listen, stop doing what you are doing and turn to God. And numerous of them actually visually put on sackcloth and ashes. They fasted. They made themselves look different as a way of saying to the people, turn back to God. And so James is using imagery that would be familiar to those people. Change your laughter to mourning. Laughter in this sense here. It's not that it's wrong to laugh. But here, there's an association with people that are laughing all the time. Well, they're just fools. And I think that's what James is getting at. Let's not be fools here. The joy he's talking about, he's already highlighted in earlier verses, verse 3, talking about our own pleasures and how fleeting our own pleasures can be, and the joy that we get from our own pleasures are so temporary. So he's just getting people to look up and think, hang on a minute, this is folly. The way that you're living your lives is folly. You're not submitting yourself to God. Verse 11, James returns to the tongue. Just think about what was said in chapter 3 about the tongue. And when he refers to the law, think he's referring to the law of love. Love your neighbour as you love yourself. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your strength. And here, when you slander one another, you're breaking that law of love. And actually, you're making a judgment on it. You're saying, it don't really matter. When we kind of just drive along a road at 40 miles an hour and a 30, we don't consciously say it, but we're actually saying, that law doesn't apply to me. It's not important. Don't make a kind of a conscious decision to kind of flout it like that, but essentially, if we consciously do that, if we consciously drive at 40 and we know it's a 30, we're saying it don't matter. Don't apply to me. And I think that's something of what James is saying here. You slander your brother, you're basically saying, well, that thing that God says about love your neighbour as yourself, you're actually saying that doesn't apply. You're saying, nah, I know better. I'll make my own laws up. Again, verse 13 could seem a little bit bizarre. As it talks about today or tomorrow, we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, make money. We could misunderstand that. People could be saying, well, actually, therefore, it's completely wrong to plan ahead. It's completely wrong to go into business. It's completely wrong to make money. That is not what it's saying. Because we need to be salt and light in the world and do what God has gifted us to do to the best of our abilities. God is calling each of us to live out who we have been created in Jesus, in the places we've been created, to work, to make money. Do it honestly, do it fairly. And what James is actually saying here is do it in submission to God. When you see that in line with verse 16, boasting and bragging, saying, well, I just do what I like. I am the master of my own destiny. I'll do as I please because I'm at the centre. I'm worth it, to quote a certain cosmetics company. I. That's what James is criticising here. The attitude of total self-centeredness and an ignoring of God. So what's the remedy? What's the remedy to all these things that James picks out throughout chapter 4? Let me tell you another little story of a captain who was at the bridge. He's on the bridge of his ship through the night, and as it's sailing along, he sees faint lights in the distance, and he tells his signalman to send a message to the source of those lights, and he says, send this message, please, alter your course 10 degrees south. Promptly, a return message comes saying, alter your course 10 degrees north. The captain was fuming. His command had been ignored, so he sends a second message. Alter your course 10 degrees south. I am the captain. Message comes back. Alter your course 10 degrees north. I am Seaman Third Class Jones. Immediately, the captain, incandescent with rage by this point, sends a third message, knowing the fear it would evoke. Alter your course 10 degrees south. I am a battleship. Then the reply came back. Alter your course 10 degrees north. I am a lighthouse. We can find it so hard to submit to somebody else's authority. But actually, that's what James is asking us to do. Verse 6, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. See, immediately after that kind of difficult verse, verse 5, where it makes it quite clear that we have a need for God. We're not left hanging to sort it out for ourselves, but he says he gives grace to the humble. And then he follows that straight on with several quite practical outworkings of that. Submit yourselves to God then, he says. Have the humility to realize that no matter who you are, however powerful and influential or seemingly insignificant you are, you're God's creation. Have the humility to acknowledge that he is a reality. He wants, nay, demands our devotion. Seeing Stephen sitting here, having had a military career and having been in authority, Stephen, you would have expected people under your charge to submit to your authority. And you would have had people in authority over you who you would have had to submit to, whether you kind of liked it or not, I'm guessing.
Oh, yes, comes the reply.
How much more then do we need to submit to the authority of God? Noble as our armed forces are, they are still human. And just because God doesn't wield his authority like a sergeant major on a parade ground doesn't mean to say that we mustn't yield to his authority. See, the spiritual realm is very real. Jesus recognized it. Paul recognized it. Throughout Scripture, it's recognized that God is a reality, but so is Satan. And in verse 7, after it says, submit yourselves to God, there's a very practical add-on to that. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So we need to submit and we need to resist the devil. But there's a promise there that he will flee. Now I wonder how we do that. I was reading yesterday, bizarrely, this just came to my Twitter account yesterday. You'll see how incredibly erudite Twitter is. Martin Luther, 16th century theologian, great reformer of the church, said this, and I can't quite believe I'm saying this. Martin Luther said, I resist the devil, and it's often with a fart that I chase him away. What? Yes, I did say that, really. Martin Luther. Maybe it's linked to this, because he then goes on to say that actually, resisting the devil, there are three things you can do. You can resist the devil with laughter. So maybe that's where that one comes in. But you can resist the devil with prayer. And you resist the devil with fellowship with other believers. But that other bit, I can't quite get my head around that. But there we go, Martin Luther doing all his thing, resisting the devil. But resist the devil we must, as we submit ourselves to God. I guess that James uses the counterpoint in verse 8. Come near to God as we resist the devil, and God will come near to you. Ask for that cleansing. Wash your hands. Purify your hearts. Then he uses a phrase that he's already used in this letter, you double-minded. You cannot stand in both camps. You can't have one foot in the world and one foot in God's camp. You cannot be double-minded. So we mustn't dismiss what James is saying. Mustn't dismiss this business of grieving, mourning and wailing either. Maybe through a period of Lent there's a possibility where we can really focus on that, of putting things down, of recognising our frailty and saying, Lord, I give that over to you. Not that we're supposed to be doer and lifeless. Then verse 10 just rounds this off again. Humble yourselves before the Lord. He will lift you up. And he comes to one final remedy in verse 15. For those who think that the world surrounds around them, verse 15. Instead of boasting about what I do, say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. Now, in a Christian culture, we can get to saying that quite often, can't we? If the Lord wills it, we might even be really flash and put DV, Deo Volente, or Latin scholars help me out. But that sense of God willing, and it can almost just trip off the tongue. But it's not just about words, it's about our hearts. Truly submitting our plans, our decisions, our day-to-day living into God's hands. As we approach Easter, we've got no better example of submitting to God's will than Jesus himself. In the garden, before he was arrested, not my will, but yours, he said. The Son of God models submission for us. So I wonder, maybe there are things in that chapter that really resonate with you. Maybe there are other things that you today need to submit into God's hands. Maybe it's the whole of your life. You've never recognized God. And you see that actually you need to submit your life into God's hands. Maybe there's just an area of your work or your home life. Maybe it's a worry that you keep carrying and you just keep trying to do it in your own way, and you need to give it to God and ask him to help you to walk with that thing. It's kind of an easy question to ask, isn't it? What do we need to submit to God's rule? Perhaps it's more difficult to answer.